Today at Reader's Corner, Jonathan Carl, author of Tired of Winning, Donald Trump and the End of the Grand Old Party. I'm Bob Custrom. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Jonathan Carl is the chief Washington correspondent for ABC News and co-anchor of This Week with George Stephanopoulos. He has reported from the White House under four presidents and 14 press secretaries. His previous books include Front Row at the Trump Show, which was an instant New York Times bestseller, as was Betrayal, the final act of the Trump Show. In his latest book, Tired of Winning, Donald Trump and the End of the Grand Old Party, Jonathan Carl tracks Trump's improbable journey from disgraced and defeated former president to a man beset by legal troubles to the dominant force yet again in the Republican Party, despite his extremist rhetoric. Jonathan Carl, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, Jonathan, I loved your book. I'll start at the first chapter and talk about the trilogy. This isn't your first rodeo when it comes to covering Donald Trump. Front Row at the Trump Show, Betrayal, and now Tired of Winning. How long have you covered him?
I mean, I've known Trump and first covered him back in 1994. So I guess we're coming on 30 years. Now it wasn't like 30 years of nonstop coverage, thank God. but you know, I was a reporter for the New York Post, and I first, you know, he was actually a pretty reliable source from time to time back in those years.
Sure, sure. Well, in your first chapter, you have two or three lines that I found very interesting. One, the story this book will tell is one of failure. The biggest loser in the history of modern politics, Donald Trump. A Republican saying, I think this was a quote, "We can't win with this guy anymore." And finally, your quote, "He has remade the party in his own image. No one is going to doubt that." But this morning in the New York Times, the lead headline, "Democrats keep hoping it's curtains for Trump. He's still center stage." That's what's so remarkable about what's going on at the moment, is it not?
I mean, it is absolutely remarkable the way he managed to take over the Republican Party, especially when you think if you go back to 2015 when he first announced he was running for president. First of all, none of them took him seriously. None of them thought he would have a chance of winning. And then, as he started to win in that primary, there was an all-out effort to try to defeat him by the kind of what you would call the establishment of the Republican Party. And if you remember, they even engineered this thing that Reince Priebus, who was then the chairman, you know, an oath that everybody, all the candidates would have to sign saying they would support the nominee. That was because they all feared that Trump would not win, but then he would like go and become a third party candidate, and they wanted to keep him inside the tent. But I think over the years, by trying to keep him inside the tent, he ended up capturing their party.
What's the significance of Trump choosing Waco, Texas as his first rally of the 2024 candidacy?
Well, I'll tell you, there's no question what the significance is. He was invoking what happened in Waco, Texas in 1993 with the Branch Davidians when, as you know, the Branch Davidians, a cult led by David Koresh, were thought to be stockpiling weapons and explosives, and the Bureau of Alcohol and Tobacco and Firearms, along with federal marshals, the FBI, did a seizure of their compound, Mount Carmel, they called it. And that siege went on for, you know, almost 2 months. And ultimately, when the federal agents moved in, it ended in a disaster, and the whole place went up in flames. 81 people died. And that's not why he did it specifically because of that, but because that disaster ended up becoming a rallying cry for the far right in the United States as an example of the government being out to get its own people. So back then it was like the New World Order. Now we call it the Deep State, but it was this belief that they did it to the Branch Davidians, and now they're going to do it to us next. And you saw these militia groups, these armed militia groups set up across the country. Some of them openly violent, some of them not. Some of them were citizens who felt that the government was coming to get them, so they wanted to learn how to defend themselves from when that happened. But one of the people that was inspired by that, of course, was Timothy McVeigh. And Timothy McVeigh 2 years later, goes into Oklahoma City, drives the, you know, a truck full of explosives to the Alfred Murrah Federal Building, and boom, you know, 168 people are dead, the biggest domestic act of terrorism in American history. And here's Donald Trump, almost 30 years to the day after what happened in Waco, returning to Waco and talking about a federal government that is out of control, that is out to get its own people, that is dangerous, a deep state that needs to be rooted out and utterly annihilated. I mean, the words are not that much different from the words that we heard from Timothy McVeigh. And if there were any doubt, and look, I'm not saying that Trump was calling for terrorism, but certainly words that can be used to inspire terrorism. But I reached out to Steve Bannon, who was, of course, Trump's chief strategist, the campaign chairman in 2016, you know, and now, once again, very much incredibly influential voice in Trump world, and said, Waco, Texas, what are you thinking? Why is this happening? And he said to me, and the quote's in the book, it's on the record, he said, we are the Trump Davidians. And the message is, our government is dangerous. Trump needs to go in and clean those people out.
Well, they even modified the Star Spangled Banner at that initial rally. I mean, you might want to share with our listeners the work of what I think is called the J6 Prison Choir. I mean, that's certainly a touch of terrorism thrown into this rally when you stop and think of who those guys were.
Well, and also think about, I'll explain that, but think about this. This is the very first rally of his 2024 campaign. So this is a highly significant event for his campaign. And usually when a candidate for office is plotting their first rally for a presidential nomination, you might do it in New Hampshire, you might do it in Iowa, you might do it in your home, it's someplace significant to your life story. You might do it in South Carolina, another early primary state. He chose Texas, which has no significance whatsoever. And then he starts it out with what you're alluding to, this Star Spangled Banner is playing over the speakers, performed by a group of prisoners in a D.C. jail who are in prison for their role in attacking the Capitol on January 6th. And they've, you know, managed to get out this recording of them singing the national anthem. And Trump, in this recording, is heard kind of layered over it saying the Pledge of Allegiance. But that's not the craziest part at all. The craziest thing is, while Trump is standing on the stage and this song is playing out over the speakers, there are these two massive video screens on either side of the stage, and they are showing images of the assault on the Capitol on January 6th. This is the start of his campaign. Now, I think some people got to him and said, hey, you better not do that again. That people might not like that. That's not really a, you know.
Yeah.
But that's how he started, and that set the tone for the campaign to come.
Steve Bannon told you that his keynote address at the Conservative Political Action Conference 1 month before Trump's first indictment was his come retribution speech. I did not understand until I read your book what that meant, but please share that with us on just where these guys are coming from on this.
Well, first of all, there's a book by a group of three Civil War historians called Come Retribution, uh-huh. The Confederate Secret Service and the Assassination of Abraham Lincoln. So Come Retribution was the code word for the Confederate Secret Service's plot to kidnap and assassinate Abraham Lincoln. And I didn't know that either, so full confession. I didn't know that. I was not aware of that book. But Bannon was describing to me the significance of this CPAC speech, which is really where it's the speech where he used that line, which I think is the motto of the campaign. First, before he says it, he says, in 2016, I said, I am your voice. Now I say to you, I am your retribution. It's all about revenge and retribution against Trump's enemies. And Bannon kept on calling it the come retribution speech, come retribution speech. And the line kept on like, why is he saying that? And then after I spoke to him about it, I came to realize that come retribution had this connotation. But did Bannon mean that? Did he know that? So I called him up and I said, well, what come retribution? He's like, oh yeah, have you read the book? It's amazing. And I mean, no, he's invoking, he's using the Confederate. I mean, you can't even like, I mean, it sounds like this couldn't be true. It is. And it's on the record. And I have the audio tapes of it. And by the way, after the book came out, Bannon sent me a message. Just remember the context is very important. I was like, okay, now he's going to explain what he really meant. And he said, the Confederate Secret Service was responding to reports that Lincoln had ordered the assassination of the entire Confederate cabinet. So this was their effort to get retribution against that. It's not, I'm not saying it to embrace the cause of the Confederacy, slavery, but the idea is going out and getting retribution against your enemies.
Mm-hmm.
But what an example to use. You probably could have come up with others, right?
Exactly. So you have a most interesting chapter called The Crazy Factor. Let's start with the Goldwater Rule. What role does the Goldwater Rule play here in preventing psychiatrists from weighing in on the mental stability of a president? And one by the way. One did anyway. That was Dr. Bandy Lee, I believe, who wrote a book called The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President. Anyway.
Yeah, well, just to explain the Goldwater Rule very quickly. When Barry Goldwater ran for president, there was a publication, I think it was called Talk Magazine.
Yeah, but it was.
And it was a group of psychiatrists who said that Barry Goldwater was crazy and therefore dangerous and shouldn't be elected president. And he sued after the election and sued successfully, saying that none of them had examined him. They had no basis to call him, you know, crazy. And I think it was the American Psychiatry Association came up with essentially a rule. It's like you cannot diagnose somebody with a mental illness unless you have actually examined them and have a basis for that diagnosis. So I just invoked that because when Trump became president, there were a group of psychiatrists who also had never actually met or examined Trump who said, look, we can see from his behaviors that he is dangerously mentally unstable. And they held a whole conference at Yale University, everything else, but it was criticized. And I said, look, you could criticize Bandy Lee and those psychiatrists. They were doing exactly what people were saying about Goldwater. Maybe they had a lot more to go with than the people saying that about Goldwater did. But the point is that that was in 2017. Over the intervening years, there were others who would come and call Trump mentally unstable, mentally ill, crazy, if you will, dangerous because of his mental instability. And those were people that were very close to Trump. And I tell the story of Mick Mulvaney, who was the acting chief of staff in 2019, who, when he gets the job, starts recommending people in the West Wing read another book called A First-Rate Mental Illness, which makes the case before Trump, and doesn't mention Trump, and it was written before Trump, that some of the best leaders in history during times of crisis had at least some mental illness. And that might have contributed to their ability to think outside the box and be great leaders. And it mentions Churchill, mentions Abraham Lincoln, it mentions FDR, and some of the most sane people in history, Neville Chamberlain, McClellan, were actually very unsuccessful in times of crisis. So why is Mulvaney recommending this book? He is because he wants to tell people, look, he may be nuts, but that might not be a bad thing. But more importantly, in this chapter, I get to what happened after January 6th, which is there was a real movement. There were reports of it at the time, but I document it and give you the evidence, chapter and verse, that people in Trump's cabinet were actively considering invoking the 25th Amendment to remove Trump from office by declaring him mentally incapable to handling the job. They didn't end up doing it. There were resignations. A couple of those that would have been part of it resigned in the cabinet, would no longer have had a vote. It didn't happen. And this included, these discussions included Mike Pompeo and Steve Mnuchin, two people who served the entirety of the 4 years of the Trump administration and were very close to him.
Well, there's another Republican official you quote, and as serious a matter as this is, I couldn't help but laugh at Governor Chris Sununu at the Gridiron Dinner was asked if Trump was crazy. And he said, I don't think this is in your book. I don't think he's so crazy that you could put him in a mental institution. But I think if he were in one, he ain't getting out. That is quite.
It was, you know, I was there when he said it, and what he said before was what he said before was pretty good. He gets out there to start his speech, and he starts by talking about how, you know, Trump, there was a lot of crazy stuff that happened when he was president, but I think he's really matured, and you know, he did a lot of good things for the country, and I think he's, you know, and he's really learned from some of his mistakes, and everybody's like starting to like move in their seats. What's he saying? And then he pauses, he leans in, and he says, "Nah, I'm just kidding. He's f-ing crazy." So yeah.
Well, I chose a number of your chapters and sum them up as the measure of the man, and I think you did an excellent job in giving us this inside look at who this guy really is. And I'm going to have you talk about something as trivial as Trump's golf game as the starter for this, and then I'll run through three or four other moments in your book where I think you really nailed down this personality.
Yeah, what I did as a structure for this book is it tells the story of Trump's, what we've learned about his last weeks in office that we didn't know before, and all that he did when he left office. And there's a narrative to his launching his campaign again and what it will be. And it's, you know, there's a structure in it and almost a pretty neat timeline to it. But I had things in this that I wanted to give, like you said, the measure of the man. So between some of the chapters, I have these vignettes, which are little windows into who Trump really is. So one of them is on his golf game. And this is quite revealing. It's nothing to do with politics or anything else. But you know, Trump owns a bunch of golf courses. And if you go to any of these golf courses, you can go on the wall and you can see, you know, golf clubs have club championships. They're very serious events, annual events where, you know, usually there's a prize to go with it, but there's always bragging rights. Your name goes on the wall, you get a big cup or trophy of some kind for winning the club championship. And if you go, Trump wins all the club championships at all his golf clubs. And there are, you know, the one that caught my eye, and then I give some other even more vivid example, was one that took place just last year when he has to go to, remember Diamond and Silk and Diamond or Silk, I forget which one, died, and Trump went to her yes. memorial. Mm-hmm. Well, there was a two-day golf tournament, club championship at one of his clubs in Florida. So he wasn't there for day one because he was at Diamond's, you know, memorial. So he shows up at day two, looks at the leaderboard. He's not at the top. That's not good. So he says, no, put me down for a 71. Boom, he's winning. He didn't hit a single ball. And you know what? Two-day golf tournament, he won. He got the trophy. Now, what does it say about a guy who was president of the United States who feels it's necessary to cheat to win a club's tournament? So there you go.
So how did Trump advise Republican Senate candidate Herschel Walker to challenge his opponent, who is now, of course, Senator Warnock?
Yeah, and this is a great – so Trump – it gives you an idea of how involved he was in these races that Republicans lost in 2022. So I tell the story of Herschel Walker is in debate prep. He had one debate with Warnock. And his team is in there having a debate prep going over possible questions and stuff. Herschel Walker's phone rings. He puts it on speakerphone. And I got something for you. This is what you got to do. You got to go up there and you got to say Warnock is a child molester. Just call him a child molester. There's no way. No, but people aren't going to vote for a child molester. And Herschel Walker, to his credit, says, "Sir, I can't do that. I don't have any evidence of that. There's no evidence that he's a..." He says, "No, it doesn't matter. Just say he's a child molester." And, you know, I mean, to me, it's just like the truth doesn't matter, whatever you think is going to land and work. And even Herschel Walker, who ran an outlandish campaign on many levels, had the sense to tell Trump, you know what, we can't do that.
Another measure of the man. How did Trump handle the immediate aftermath of 9/11?
I mean, that's truly an astounding story. He called into a local television station in New York and in the midst of the conversation, this horrible, the buildings are still, you know, I mean, people are cleaning the, I mean, it's, the disaster is still ongoing. It's that day. And he says, you know, but the buildings have just come down. And he's like, I have the second tallest building in lower Manhattan. Well, I guess I have the tallest now. I have the tallest building now in lower Manhattan. Tallest why? Because terrorists just brought down the Twin Towers. And he's like saying, hey, you know what? I guess there is a silver lining. I mean, he didn't say those words, but that's the implication.
Yeah. In the recent deadlock where the House couldn't elect a speaker, there was a brilliant idea that Donald Trump could be speaker because, of course, the Speaker of the House of the U.S. House of Representatives does not have to be a member until it didn't sound like a good idea for Donald Trump. You can tell us how that unfolded.
People had actually been pushing this idea, some of his, you know, nuttier supporters. I mean, Steve Bannon had actually been pushing this idea for months, for instance. And Trump had no interest in it. He wanted to be president. He didn't want to be a Speaker of the House. Why would he want to spend all that time in Congress? And he supported McCarthy, endorsed McCarthy. But as the balloting went on, if you may remember, after it got through 10 ballots or so, and all voting for different people, Matt Gaetz votes for Donald Trump for Speaker. He votes for Donald Trump for Speaker. So when the tally comes out and all the cable networks are covering this, of course, Trump is watching it on multiple TV screens. It says 212 votes for Hakeem Jeffries, 201 or whatever it was for Kevin McCarthy, X number for whoever the other Republicans were, and then one vote for Donald Trump. And, you know, Trump is like kind of embarrassed by this, and then all the cables are mocking him. But, you know, it happens again in one vote. And then he calls up Gaetz and he says, he basically sends a word, knock it off. So Gaetz doesn't vote for him the next time. And the round goes, McCarthy still doesn't win. And then Trump starts thinking, well, wait a minute. Calls Gaetz back, gets back to Gaetz and says, the reason why I only got one vote is because people didn't realize they could vote for me. You didn't put my name in nomination. Nobody had nominated me. So the very next round, Gaetz gives this rip-roaring speech nominating Donald Trump for Speaker of the House, saying he made America great again. Now he can make the House great again. And it goes through the – and by the way, everybody's like – the Democrats are all booing as he's – you know, it's a crazy scene. And goes around, one vote again. He gets one vote. Donald Trump gets one vote. So now Trump is upset, knock it off. And it was in the next round that the Republican holdouts caved and McCarthy won.
Yeah. So on the foreign policy front, President Trump was ridiculed by many foreign leaders as he traveled around the world in his 4 years as president. But your Angela Merkel story about Trump and how she manages to compare the crowds that greeted Trump and those before him. You might want to share that with us.
Yeah, this is a pretty remarkable story. This is, you know, Trump knew that Merkel had nothing but contempt for him, and it made him a little defensive. You know, he said terrible things about her all the time, but he was defensive about this. He felt a little threatened by her. And I recount a story about how Trump on multiple occasions told a Republican congressman, very senior Republican congressman, very close to Trump, you know, she told me she couldn't believe how big my crowds are, how many people come out to see me. She said, yeah, it's amazing that you do that. She told me that there's only one other person in history, one other political leader who got crowds so big. And this Republican congressman recounts this story to me. I'm like, you know who she's talking about, right? This is the Republican congressman. You know the chancellor. You know who she's talking about. And, you know, and Trump probably didn't know exactly who she was talking about. But again, there's no question now that Trump has quoted Adolf Hitler and invoked his name in a rally in Iowa. You know, there's no question that both that Trump has a longstanding obsession with Hitler. I'm not saying he is Hitler, he's a Nazi, but it's something that's fascinated him for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And there's no question also that Adolf Hitler, like Donald Trump, did get a lot of people showing up for his speeches. I mean, Trump was very well aware of that.
So there was one part of your book where I thought somebody's going to come along someday and write an entire text on this subject. And it's the favorite word of the right wing, deep state. And you're making an observation about Trump's own staff. And again, I want our listeners to understand that when most people refer to the deep state, that when the right wing refers to the deep state, they're usually thinking of this powerful bureaucracy underneath the president that will counter the work of the president. But here we're talking, you're talking about Trump's own staff, not those buried very deeply in the bureaucracy, but those who are right in the West Wing. And you share with the reader the extent to which some of Trump's orders weren't carried out. And you raise the issue of, hey, that's not the way a democratically elected president is supposed to function in the White House. But as I said, I think it raises a more interesting question of just how many times did this happen over 4 years? I mean, I know your book wasn't focused on that and you've touched on it, but I wouldn't be surprised somebody could take this one apart and do a 400-page text on how many times Trump staff found ways of just ignoring a guy who was who they thought was becoming unhinged, as we've already discussed.
It happened a lot. I've documented a few specific examples, and it raises an interesting ethical question. One of the more glaring examples of in 2020 was when Trump wanted to invoke the Insurrection Act, and he wanted to send active duty U.S. troops to the streets of American cities to put down rioters.
Yeah.
And Bill Barr thought this was a dangerous and bad thing. The defense secretary, Mark Esper, thought this was a dangerous and bad thing. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, thought it was a dangerous and bad thing. So they did everything they could to prevent him from issuing a direct order that they would then have to make a decision to defy, to resign, or to carry out. And I recounted, actually, I did this in Betrayal, my previous book, how Esper tried to fool Trump by ordering the movement of the 82nd Airborne to Fort Belvoir outside of Washington, D.C., in Virginia, to give him the – and by the way, when it happened, because troop movements, the Pentagon announces, we know they're moving. I mean, it's not a secret. There was, you know, all kinds of crazy – what's Esper doing? Does this mean we're getting ready to see troops going into Washington, D.C.? This is, you know, there was real concerns. But Esper was simply trying to fool Trump. It's like, yeah, we're moving. We're moving troops. I mean, they're not coming to K Street. They're going to be out, you know. And right. And then Esper actually announced that he would not, that the Insurrection Act was a misguided thing. It shouldn't be done. He was effectively defying Trump. Nobody elected Mark Esper. Mark Esper was nominated by Donald Trump, confirmed by the Senate, and served in Trump's cabinet. So how do you deal with that? I mean, you wouldn't want a military leader defying a president under almost any circumstance. But in this case, it was absolutely the right thing to do. But he's defying a president.
Right. And Mattis, on the other hand, chose a different route.
Yeah. Yeah. And so did H.R. McMaster, who was active duty, three-star general, stayed in the uniform as the national security advisor. And I'll very quickly tell you this, because this is something that I actually had recounted also in Betrayal. There was a meeting in the White House, national security meeting, and Trump got off. He would go off on tangents, as you can imagine. And his tangent at this point was Venezuela. And I don't know if he was thinking about voting blocks in Florida or what it was, but his Maduro was hanging on to power and, you know, resisting all U.S. pressure to get him out. And Trump wants war plans for Venezuela. Can you imagine war plans for Venezuela? One of the ideas that he was pushing for was because somebody had mentioned it to him and it captured his imagination, a military blockade of Venezuela, which, by the way, Venezuela is not an island. So a little bit of a, but whatever, put that aside. But, you know, the idea of having warships being prepared to shoot down merchant ships or passenger ships coming in and out of Venezuela is like a little bit of an escalation, okay? So, but he wants the war plans. War are the war plans. Why have I not seen them? What he's yelling at? He's yelling at his national security advisor. So the meeting breaks up, and H.R. McMaster is trying to explain to him why this is a bad idea and why there are other tools that we can use, diplomatic tools, to put pressure on Venezuela. And every time he pushes back, Trump gets angrier and is banging the table. Where are my war plans? And so the meeting breaks up. He says, okay, sir. And he goes down the hall. And John Kelly, who was also in the meeting and was a retired four-star general, starts bottling McMaster and says, where are you going? What are you doing? He's like, well, I'm going to call over to the Pentagon. He wants war plans. He's like, you are not going to do that. You can't do that. If you do that, the circle of people that will know about what he was just talking about in there is going to go much wider. There's going to be talk of the Pentagon is preparing for war against Venezuela. You cannot do that. You just ignore it. And I mean, who's right in that circumstance? Kelly didn't say a word in the moment to Trump to tell him it was a bad idea. H.R. McMaster did. He tried to make the case and he was shot down. Do you defy the president? Do you carry out his orders? It is a fascinating dilemma, to be sure.
And to be written about many times over, I'm sure, in years to come. We're about out of time, Jonathan, but I would like you to focus for a moment on that last chapter. I thought it was so beautifully stated where you come from when it comes to covering the United States government, Capitol in particular. That last chapter, I want our readers to know, is enough to buy the book right there, because I think you did such a beautiful job of helping us understand what it really means to be a patriot. And also you cite some heroic actions in there of Americans that that we need to know more about.
Yeah, I thank you for mentioning that, because it was the most heartfelt thing I've ever written in my life, the most difficult. When I, you know, I voiced my own audiobook, and when I went through to read it, it was hard to read without kind of choking up, because it's a very personal, in some ways, very personal chapter. You know, it talks about my first visits to Washington, D.C. as a young kid, and my fascination with what happened under that dome, and the miracle of democracy, and the fact that as I was watching the proceedings of Congress, I'm watching people representing the entire country. I talk about being there on 9/11 when members of Congress gather on the steps of the east side of the Capitol. And the building had been closed because the plane in Shanksville that went down in Shanksville was headed for that dome, we believe. And we didn't know if there were more terrorist attacks to come. But members of Congress gathered on the steps at night, about 11 o'clock at night. I was there, and they started spontaneously singing God Bless America before leaving. And I talk about the history of that building. I talk about John F. Kennedy's profiles in courage, which he wrote about, examples of courage of U.S. senators over history. I tell the story of Sam Houston, which I think is highly relevant to our current situation, by the way. And I talk about the Republicans that had the courage to stand up to Trump, despite what it meant for their careers and, in some cases, the safety of themselves and their families. And, you know, I think it's the most important and compelling part of the book. It's the book's got, you know, I'm glad you mentioned it, because this book has gotten a lot of attention, which I'm very grateful for. Most of the attention is on the news that's broken in the book. There's lots of new reporting about stuff Trump did, people around Trump. I mean, there's a lot of what you call like news breaks. The conclusion is not that. I'm not breaking news, but I'm bringing it all together, and why I'm trying to explain why, when I saw that building come under attack by Americans carrying flags that for the most part weren't American flags, but flags for a man, Trump flags, and rampaging through that building, going onto the Senate floor, a place that I revered. I mean, this is the Senate floor, and going through the desks and what those desks mean. Watching the Q shaman or whatever, you know, going up and leaving a threatening note on the presiding officer's seat for Mike Pence. I think it ties it together. I also, if you've kind of gotten me going, so I'm sorry, but there's a particular moment for me. You know, that plane that went down in Shanksville on September 11, as you know, it was the passengers on that plane that stormed in the cockpit and sacrificed their own lives, because they saw what the other planes had done to the Twin Towers. So they heard, because they were able to get on the phones in the plane. So they knew what had happened, and they didn't want their plane to be a weapon to similarly do whatever it was going to do. And as you know, the story goes, Todd Beamer, one of the passengers on that plane, graduate of Wheaton College, is heard to say, "Let's roll," before the charge on the cockpit happens. All those people died. And they probably saved us from, we don't know for sure if the plane was going to the Capitol, but that's the kind of leading assumption. I was in the Capitol on September 11th during the day as well. And it was quickly evacuated when there were reports of that plane coming in. And I didn't want to evacuate. because I'm a reporter and this was the biggest story in my lifetime. And I thought it was important for me to be there. So I'm like one of the very last people to leave that building. Sometime after September 11, Todd Beamer's widow came to the Capitol and I met with her and I went in with her into the House chamber and I sat there with her in there was nothing, you know, the building was not open to the public yet for like public tours and stuff. There were not many people around. And we sat in a, basically an empty House chamber in the galleries above. And we were kind of silent for a minute as I looked around. All I'm thinking in my head is, well, I say to her, I say what I'm thinking, which is because of your husband, this is still here. He saved this. And I said to her, and he probably saved my life too. And so again, to see that place, for all the flaws of American democracy and all the scoundrels that have served in there and all the, you know, disappointments and everything else, that's where it's all done. And that's the symbol of our democracy. And the fact that those people were defiling it is something that, you know, I actually took personally.
So eloquently stated, the name of the book is Tired of Winning, Donald Trump and the End of the Grand Old Party. The author is who you've been listening to for these last few minutes, Jonathan Carl, Chief Washington Correspondent for ABC TV. And Jonathan, I just want to thank you for writing the book and thank you for giving us so much of your time today.
Hey, well, thank you. And it's really great to talk to you. And I hope all is well in Boise.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.